in the hallowed halls of St. John's College to the Department of Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic at the University of Cambridge. I should warn you that while the following offers no little insight into the professional lives of antiquarian academics, the sort of questions medievalists investigate, it will not be fun at all, and will may well contribute increasingly to shooting pains in your heads. Caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. Surveying the corpus of Anglo-Saxon texts, if most readers have, perhaps understandably, taken tales of warriors such as Beowulf battling monsters unto gory and glorious death as the epitome of that which is interesting about Old English literature, then at the other side of the continuum, as distant as Cambridge is from Kalamazoo, must reside Anglo-Saxon prose, dull as dishwater to that monotony, that Duke of Dreariness, that tyrant, must surely be Alfred of Incham and his homiletic prose. For those so hardened, however, to the patently uninspiring as to trudge through the bleak midwinter in the throes of a taxing term to listen to pontifications on for the nativity, I have a special treat. For Alfred has not one, not two, nay, not four, but six sermons for this festive occasion, and you, O best beloveds, will get to hear about them all. For those of you who have blissfully escaped my previous dronings on about Alfred, a brief bit of background might well be in order. Now scarcely known, ironically, to most students of literature, the 10th century monk Alfred of Incham was the most erudite, prolific, and influential readable over the next three centuries as the vernacular changed. The popularity of Alfred's writings remained remarkably steadfast. Reproduced widely in England through the 12th and 13th centuries, his works continued to be translated on the continent thereafter and copied in Old English, even in such distant lands as 15th century Romania. Stylistically, Alfred's influence was profound. Adapting the features of Old English verse, he created a fluid combination of alliteration and rhythm that made his language both memorable and attractive to later writers. In the late 12th century, Laemmle's Brut, a classic work of the Arthurian tradition, draws directly on Alfred for its style. And to Alfred may be indebted the alliterative revival of the 14th and 15th century, when writings such as Sir Gawain and the Green Knight consciously harkened back to Old English poetic forms. Indeed, though Alfred's innovative style has traditionally been labeled, his groundbreaking study this year has cogently redefined him as Anglo-Saxon England's most prolific poet. Such a perspective poses an innate challenge to a long-standing scholarly and pedagogical bias that is focused primarily on heroic poems copied or written during this period, such as Beowulf, and viewed the Anglo-Saxon world as a closed tradition ending with the Norman conquest, rather than the dynamic part of a larger literary and intellectual development in Western Europe. It is the content of Alfred's works, however, that best explains and justifies their far-reaching impact, for he was a man with a pedagogical mission. Alfred was a leading figure of the 10th century Benedictine Reform, one of the most pivotal movements of English literary and intellectual history, in which a small group of ecclesiastical reformers engineered a resurgence of literacy in a land decimated by Viking invasion. Distressed at his contemporaries' ignorance of basic theology, and recognizing that few had knowledge of Latin, Alfred sought to make the writings of church fathers, such as Augustine, accessible not only to clergy, but to laity as well through a complex process of synthesis and translation. Simply consider the storm surrounding Luther's translation of the Bible to understand the potentially controversial nature of this endeavor. Remarkably, Alfred is transparent about the challenge and danger of his enterprise. In sharp contrast to the majority of Old English texts where we do well to know the author's name, Alfred's writings reveal a self-conscious author who provides insight into his pedagogical concerns and struggles. Such misgivings, however, do not prevent Alfred from grappling directly with issues that had occupied the greatest minds of the church: free will, predestination, the dual nature of Christ, and so on, and trying to make them intelligible to a largely illiterate audience. In the process, he not only affirms the suitability of the English language as a vehicle for complex theological exposition, but manifests the Anglo-Saxon's ability to digest, transform, and export intellectual traditions originally inherited from abroad, a fundamental characteristic of English literature down through the Middle Ages and Renaissance. Indeed, some of Alfred's own works became the subject of such transformation 550 years on, when Elizabeth's Archbishop of Canterbury translated and published them, verbatim but out of context, to justify various doctrinal positions of the Anglican Church. Alfred's theology, therefore, serves as a crucial bridge not only between the early church and the Old English period, but between the 10th century Reform and the 16th century Renaissance. Page 1 of your handout seeks to situate Alfred's sermon, his 6 sermons for Christmas, in the context of this influential corpus. First, there's the Sermo de Natali Domini, a sermon on the Lord's birth from Alfred's first series of Sermones Catholici, or Catholic homilies. Arguably the jewel of Alfred's homiletic crown, the sermones were sets of homilies composed for Alfred's own use as a priest of Chernobyl, which he revised and issued in 2 series dedicated to Cyrich, Archbishop of Canterbury, from 990 to 994 or 95, to provide clergy with Orthodox preaching material in the vernacular, in Old English. Alfred opens the first series with a sermon on the beginning of creation, Initio Creaturae, discussing the nature of the Trinity, the fall of the rebellious angels, the creation and fall of mankind, and the nature of men's souls, all themes to which he will return in his Christmas addresses. Sermon Natali Domini, to which we may refer hereafter as Alfred's first series Christmas sermon, then follows as the first of Alfred's compositions for the temporale, or liturgical year. Alfred's second series Christmas sermon, Sermon Natali Domini ad populum excerptus to testimonies prophetarum, a sermon on the Lord's birth to the people taken from the witnesses of the prophets, similarly leads off his subsequent set of sermones. Not long thereafter, perhaps before Alfred's composition of the Lives of Saints, or accounts of virtuous figures, late in the period 993 to 1002, we find text number 3 in the Natali Domini Ratione Anime, on the Lord's birth and regarding the doctrine of the soul. A Latin text, found solely in a manuscript we will have further occasion to discuss, Boulogne-sur-Mer, Bibliothèque Municipale 63. The Boulogne sermon is closely tied to the 2 Old English texts that follow. Nativitas Domini Nostri Jesu Christi, the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ, which begins the Lives of Saints, a collection I've consistently, while writing this paper, typed as the Lives of Satans, a decidedly luxurious and problematic title for a Benedictine work, and In Natali Domini, on the Lord's birth, printed as the 9th entry in A.O. Belfour's 12th century homilies in MS Bodley 343. Finally, late in Alfred's career, we have the Nativitas Domini, the birth of the Lord, another Old English text printed as the first entry in John Pope's supplementary collections of Alfred's homilies. To these, we may refer as the Lives of Saints sermon, Belfour 9, and the supplementary sermon, respectively. As not all of you, one hopes, will spend your days lingering over the pages of these sermons, a brief overview of their context may well be in order. For his first series, sermonly to begin with, Alfred draws on at least 5 sources. 2 sermons by the 8th century English luminary, the Venerable Bede, 1 by the 6th century apostle to the English, Pope Gregory the Great, 1 by the 5th century church father par excellence, Augustine of Hippo, and an extract from the 7th century Spanish father, Isidore of Seville, de Ecclesiasticis Officiis, on ecclesiastical responsibilities. All 5 were likely available to Alfred through one of his primary immediate sources for the sermones, the Homiliary of Paul the Deacon, that collection of patristic readings commissioned by Charlemagne at the end of the 8th century, hugely influential. Not all appear in the original version of Paul the Deacon, but the exception, Bede's Homiliae 1-6, is included in an expanded form of Paul the Deacon from the later Middle Ages. In addition, Alfred's homily may draw on a Christmas sermon by the 9th century Benedictine monks Hierich of Auxerre, but of this we need not speak further. In his first serious homily, Christmas homily number 1, Alfred begins by conflating and translating 2 gospel readings for the day, Luke 2:1-14 and 2:15-20. In view is the Lucan Christmas story, the census by Caesar Augustus in the time of Cyrenius, Quirinius, the journey of Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem, the glorious appearance of the heavenly host and the shepherds beholding of the child in the manger. Having followed Isidore and Bede for some opening remarks, in a possibly original passage, Alfred identifies the emperor as Octavian, who is named Augustus because he increases his dominions to the end of the earth, Augustus ostensibly deriving from the Latin augoscere, to increase, even as Christ adds the vast host of mankind to his heavenly kingdom to replace the fallen angels. In another unsourced section, Alfred interprets Cyrenus as heir, even as Christ and those who believe in him are heirs to the Father's kingdom. Returning to his patristic sources, Alfred explains that men were called to pay tribute to Caesar, even as believers are called to offer their faith to God. That Bethlehem, the house of bread, represents Christ, the true bread on which the faithful feed. That the babe is laid in a narrow manger so that he might free men from the straits of hell. And so on, presenting the spiritual significance of the various details of the Christmas account. A decidedly different approach is taken by Alfred's second series sermon, composed between 1 and 5 years later. Professor Malcolm Godden of Oxford University, in his recent commentary on the Sermones, states that, quote, "This is one of the most independent of the second series homilies, relying little on direct translation from Latin sources apart from the Bible, showing the sort of parallels with Alfred's earlier homilies and their sources that would suggest further reflection on earlier work. Alfred is mulling over his source text." The first third of the sermon, perhaps drawing loosely on another extract from Isidore's Ecclesiastes Officiis, and sermons by Augustine and pseudo-Augustine, likely found in Alfred's copy of Paul the Deacon, considers larger questions arising from the incarnation account. First, Alfred distinguishes between Christ's eternal begetting from the Father and his earthly birth. Next, he discusses the dual nature of Christ and the unique capacity of the God-man to atone for humanity's sin. Pausing to note, an Old Testament type of the Virgin Mary, Aaron's staff, which bore fruit without being planted in the ground, a bit of inversion imagery here, in fact, Alfred goes on to delineate four types of human creation: the creation of Adam by God, the creation of Eve from Adam, the generation of children through normal procreation, and the engendering of Christ in Mary's womb, even as the Church engenders spiritual children through the waters of baptism. Remember this general approach to delineating the created order, for we will see it again. From such larger questions, Alfred turns to the main focus of the sermon, the matters excerptus from testimonies prophetarum, those taken from the witnesses of the prophets, promised by the sermon's title. In his first series homily for the first Sunday in Advent, Alfred had explicitly made the connection of Old Testament prophecy and the Christmas season. Nous stand se iuna on God's lethalium, that el God stand on churchlium thenium, edria on halum redum, the custom now stands in God's congregation that all God's people in church services at this time, both in holy readings and in melodious songs, recite daily the accounts of the prophets. Perhaps in consequence, here at the beginning of his second series, Alfred sets forth 24 prophecies concerning the Messiah and the Messiah's coming. The majority of these may come from the pseudo-Augustinian sermon, or an anonymous life of James the Apostle, but at least 7 appear to have derived from an unidentified and unusually garbled source. For a sermon where source attribution is a distinct challenge, Godden states that, quote, "the quotations are a particular problem since they show a surprising amount of misattribution, unusual wording, untraceable citations, and odd interpretations," unquote. This is extraordinarily unusual for Alfred, who is one of the most conscientious authors from the Old English period to draw on Latin, patristic, and vernacular sources. In addition to such familiar passages as Isaiah's "Behold, a virgin shall conceive," or "To us a child is born," or "He shall be led like a lamb to the slaughter," Alfred presents, for examples, passages ostensibly from Micah, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah. Micah, he said, speaks of Christ as the peace-bringer, "Thonabith sib on erdon thona, ur drichten kumath to ur land." Then there will be peace on earth when our Lord comes to our land and when he goes into our houses. In fact, however, Micah 5:5 states that "erit isti pax Assyrius cum venerit in terram nostrum quando cavit in dominis nostris." This man will be our peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall set food into our houses. Alfred appears to substitute the Lord's coming for that of the Assyrian, whom Jerome and Hamo interpret as the devil, against whom the promised one stands. Shortly after, Alfred turns to what he says is a passage from Ezekiel regarding the Messiah and the city of Jerusalem. "Thin kunin cometh to Ezmod," and so forth. "Your king comes to you humble and shall reestablish you." The text appears to echo Matthew's quotation from Zechariah 9:9 regarding the triumphal entry. "Ecce rex tus venit tibi monsetus and sedit super asinam." "Behold, your king comes to you mild and sitting on a donkey." There's a passage from pseudo-Jeremiah, which says, "And this will be his sign. He will open the eyes of the blind, to the deaf he will give hearing, and with his voice he will raise the dead from their graves." Well, the quotation, while by no means unbiblical in tone, may not, in fact, be from the Bible, let alone from Jeremiah. Godin speculates that it may be, quote, a garbled and misattributed version of a passage from Isaiah that immediately follows in Alfred's text. Whatever the reason for Alfred's inclusion of these prophecies, however, they illustrate nicely the degree to which the second series sermon departs from a careful exposition of the details of the Christmas story, and as such from Alfred's first homily in the first series. If we jump from the beginning to the end of Alfred's career and move after 1005 from Cerne to Incham, just west of Oxford, we come to another Christmas Day homily, this one printed at the beginning of John Pope's supplementary collection of Alfredian sermons. This is Christmas homily number 6. While the texts in Pope's collection are varied in date, representing as they do a miscellany of sermons unedited at the time of Peter Klemo's 1959 chronology of Alfred's works, Pope is led to regard this Christmas homily as relatively late among Alfred's works, quote, because of its easy mastery of a wealth of learning. It is, Pope says, one of the most varied yet most skillfully organized of the homilies, but certainly does not so late to have suffered any diminution of energy. Its imperfect preservation is much to be regretted. Pope's regret stems in part from the fact that the Christmas homily survives in only one manuscript, an early copy of the first series produced around the year 1000. An appendix, added by a nearly contemporary hand, includes 5 more texts by Alfred, his set of 5 homilies for the Fridays in Lent. The real change, however, occurred some 20 or 30 years thereafter, when a third scribe considerably augmented the volume, substantially adding to 2 existing sermons and inserting 17 extra sermons at the appropriate points for the liturgical year. In an attempt to integrate this material smoothly, the interpolator removed folios, erased material, and recopied passages onto fresh leaves. Pope's Christmas homily is one of the texts so included. Unfortunately, however, the manuscript entrusted with this now unique material was London British Library Cotton Vitellius C5, part of Sir Robert Cotton's priceless collection of Anglo-Saxon manuscripts, including our sole copy of Beowulf, that was ravaged by fire at Ashburnham House, London, in 1731. Alfred's last Christmas homily treats not the Lucan account of Christ's nativity, but an alternate pericope, or scriptural reading, John 1, 1-14. In the beginning of the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. As Pope observes, Alfred here treats the challenging opening of that gospel, which he had treated rather sparingly in his earlier texts, and now, in the scattered homilies of his later career, treats more frequently than any other. His primary authority was one of particularly importance for the medieval church's understanding of the passage, Augustine's Tractatus in Evangelium Johannis, the tractates on the Gospel of John. In addition, Alfred relies on Bede's Homiliae 1:8, which draws on the Tractatus, as well as 2 texts which drew primarily on Bede, Alfred's Commentaria on Johannes Evangelium, and Hamo's Homilia de Tempore 9 for Christmas Day. Even more than his first series homily, Alfred's supplementary homily provides detailed phrase-by-phrase exegesis or explanation of the scriptural passage at hand. For John's opening statement that in principio erat verbum, in the beginning was the Word, for example, Alfred follows the example, if not the precise wording of Augustine, through the following line of argument. First, Christ is the Word that was in the beginning, even as Jesus tells the Pharisees, Ego principium et loquor vobis, I am the beginning who also speaks to you. Second, at the beginning, Christ is innately associated with the divine act of creation, even as Genesis says, In principio fecit Deus caelum et terram, in the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. Third, as the Word, Christ is both the divine agent of creation and one with God's breath, his spirit, even as the psalmist says, Verbo Domini Caeli fermenti sunt et spiritu oris eius omnis virtum eorum. By the word of the Lord were the heavens established, and by all their power, and all their power by the spirit of his mouth. Psalm 32. Finally, Christ is the Father's wisdom, as well as the beginning and the Word, as the psalmist again decrees, Quam magnificantia sunt opera tua Domini, omnia et sapientia fecesti. How magnificent are your works, O Lord, you have made all things in wisdom. Having considered Christ's eternality, role in creation, and relation to the other members of the Trinity, Alfred then draws on Bede to dismiss those, like Arians, one presumes, who would deny this eternal divinity. In the beginning of the Word, Alfred affirms, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Such conservative depictions of the dual nature of Christ, the nature of the Trinity, and the relationship of the Creator to his creation subsequently characterize most of the homily that follows. There are, however, at least four occasions on which Alfrich makes original and remarkable contributions to his exposition, two of which we may briefly survey here. The first of these passages is spliced between the remarks from Augustine and from Bede regarding "In the beginning was the Word." Having based his discussion of Christ's nature on four excerpts from Scripture, Alfrich bizarrely chooses to bolster his argument using the witness of Hermes Trismegistus, or thrice greatest. Hermes' prophecy, Alfrich notes, described the Son of God as the Word of Wisdom, deriving his divine nature from God alone. Alfrich's implied point may be that the truth of Christ's nature is evident even to pagans, not merely to the inspired. Indeed, as they note Paul's condemnation in Romans of philosophers who, quote, knew God but did not honor him or give him thanks, unquote. Alfrich, however, goes out of his way to find and include this Hermetic testimony, which he then describes merely as worthy for its michlam wisdom, its great wisdom. As Hermes Trismegistus was, in fact, a pagan deity at the center of 2nd and 3rd century Gnostic-like Egyptian mystery religion, however, his presence sets ill at ease against the Bedean condemnation of heresy that immediately follows. Again, to some extent, Alfrich's ignorance may be excused. Alfrich's source, Quod Voldeus, 5th century Adversus Quinque Heresis, against five heresies, was attributed to Augustine until modern times. Nonetheless, the interpolation is an unusual one for Alfrich, particularly in light of the theological complexity of the issue and Alfrich's keen sense of the limitations of his audience. The other passage we may consider comes towards the end of John's pericope, where John states that, to as many as received him, Christ gave power to be made sons of God. Beginning with the psalmist's statement, quoted in John 10:34 and cited by Augustine near the beginning of the Tractatus, that ego dixi die estis et filii excelsi omnes, I said, you are gods, you are all the sons of the Most High, Psalm 81, Alfrich reflects on what it means for believers to be sons of God. The passage from the Psalms is the classic text for this question, as Jesus uses it in John 10 to refute the Jews' charge that he is blasphemed by identifying himself with God. Alfrich, however, recalls two other occasions where similar language is used. First, he notes, God tells Moses that Ecce constitui te Deum Pharaonis, I've made you God to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet, in Exodus 7. And second, there is the beginning of Psalms 81, which presents God as standing in Synagoga Deorum, in the congregation of the gods, and in their midst he judges the gods. The Almighty, Alfrich concludes, het us mana gurus, he calls us men gods. The tenor is awestruck and reflective rather than sensational and speculative. Like the first family, Alfrich's exposition may stay close to the scriptural text. Like the second series sermon, it may reach far-reaching theological themes. If his inclusion as Hermes is somewhat troubling, however, overall his treatment of John here seems that of a biblical scholar in his maturity, seeing in the birth of the babe the deep things of God. At this point, we turn back to the sermons found in the middle of Alfrich's corpus, the Bologna Sermon, the Lives of Saints, the Bologna Sermon, the Lives of Saints Sermon, and Belfour 9. Repeatedly, for those stealing themselves for a droning itemization of the contents of yet another three only one overview is needed, as there is considerable correspondence between them, as page 2 of your handout will show. Now be not dismayed by the diminutive text before you. You're not expected to read the sermons printed on this page. Simply note the theme. Bottom left-hand vertical stripes and underlining, indicating a few analogous passages in the Bologna Sermon and Belfour 9, the first and third columns on the page. Diagonal stripes in the first two columns indicate text at the beginning of Bologna and the Lives of Saints. Light gray in the second and third columns denotes correspondences at the beginning of the ends of the Lives of Saints in Belfour 9. And swaths of black, covering by far the majority of these pieces, highlight points of correspondence between all three. The pattern followed by this swarthy material is as follows. Like the supplementary homilies, it begins by considering Christ's beginning, his incarnation, his eternal divinity, his identification as the beginning, ego sum principium, as he tells the Jews, and his timeless participation in eternity. Like the supplementary sermon, moreover, it rebuffs those who would question Christ's eternality, either as heretics or as foolish, over-curious souls. Here, Alfrich uses a favorite and possibly original image, which he repeats in a text composed some years thereafter, De Creatore et De Creatura, on the Creator and the Creation, a battered text surviving uniquely in another Cotton manuscript, Cotton Author C1, Volume 2. This likewise deals with the Trinitarian nature of the Creator and his relation to the created order. In all four texts, Alfrichs uses the image of man climbing a tall ladder, who reaches its end and yet desires to ascend still higher. Seeking to go beyond what is possible or permissible, that man falls headlong, and so much the harder the higher he had climbed. Just so, warns Alfrichs, will doom befall him who questions what existed before the beginning, that is, before God. Next, like the second series sermon, the black material distinguishes categories among existing beings. Some have had both a beginning and end, like beasts. Some have a beginning but no end, like angels and men. And God himself has neither beginning nor end. This brings Alfred to a further consideration of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, or divine wisdom proceeding from the Father, and the Spirit, or divine will and love proceeding from them both. In a description drawing ultimately on the climatic peroration of Alfred the Great's version of Boethius' De Consolation of Philosophy, Alfrich depicts the all-encompassing attributes of God before moving to yet another delineation of the created order. Invisible spirits, beasts that crawl or swim or fly, and human beings who walk upright that they may direct their thoughts toward heavenly rather than earthly things. Here begins the second part of Alfrich's three sermons, aptly described by Bologna's title, in Natale Domini de Ratione Anime, on the Lord's birth and regarding the doctrine of the soul. Drawing on Alcuin's De Anima Ratione, Alfrich outlines the trifold nature of the soul. That is, man's desire. Are you looking ahead in the handout?
I'm looking to find out where we are.
We are. You have page 2, I think. 2. You have not gone further.
No. Thank you very much.
No. I must be ever vigilant. Drawing on Alcuin's De Anima Ratione, Alfrich outlines the trifold nature of the soul, that is, man's capacities for desire, anger, and reason, and the subtly devin sins that flow from their mismanagement. He distinguishes between the memory, understanding, and will, lists the 5 chief virtues or powers by which men eschew evil, discusses 8 different terms for the soul and the 5 physical senses which the soul governs, and identifies the soul's beauty as the love of wisdom. Such an analysis of the soul may seem odd, juxtaposed with a discussion of the Trinity, but Alfrich is clarifying the difference between divine and human nature, both of which subjects flow naturally from a consideration of beginnings, specifically the earthly beginning of the only one to combine both human and divine natures. About such subjects, Alfrich is keenly concerned. As he says when transitioning from one section to another, quote, "There is nothing more important to any man living that then he knows the Almighty God through faith, and afterward knows his own soul." If such is the content of the swarthy textual darkness which seems to envelop so much of these three sermons, in what ways do the texts differ? A glance at the Bologna sermon, first of all, the first column on your handout, reveals 3 major blocks of white or supplements to the basic text. First, Alfrich here follows the image of the ladder with another warning against heresy. Even as God warns the Israelites not to ascend by steps up to his altar, Alfrich says, Exodus 20, so men should not seek to overstep the altar, that is, God, by believing the Son or the Spirit to be inferior to the other members of the Trinity. As with the ladder, one who seeks so to ascend will fall inevitably into the depths. Second, following the acclamation of God's characteristics derived from Alfred the Great, Alfrich pauses to reflect on the dual nature of Christ, perfect man and perfect God, predestined to be incarnate by the Father's eternal will. Third, following a discussion of Christ as the bread of life, present only in Bologna and Belfour 9, Alfrich urges believers to love peace and truth by loving their neighbors. In that way, Alfrich said, men please God and follow the way of Christ. Those who have faulted in lies, by contrast, are sons of the devil, the chief of liars and the father of lies. They will have no dwelling place hereafter, save with the demons in eternal fire. Fewer major points of departure are found in the Lives of Saints sermon and Belfour 9, the second and third columns on your handout. In the Lives of Saints, on the one hand, having distinguished between invisible spirits, beasts, and upright men, Alfrich reiterates that all these creatures, unlike God, have a beginning. Using an image perhaps derived ultimately from Augustine, Alfrich states that just as light proceeds from the sun and heat from the sun and its light, so the sun proceeds from the Father and the Spirit from them both. In Belfour 9, on the other hand, Alfrich adds general statements regarding the virgin birth, mankind's redemption through Christ's sacrifice, and the future dwelling of believers with the angels in heavenly bliss. In addition, he reiterates points made elsewhere regarding God's creation of all things, the eternal beginning of the Son, the various emanations of the Son and Spirit, and so forth. In short, the three sermons offer different elaborations of imagery and some development of shared themes, but otherwise treat much the same subjects. The relationship between these three texts, however, is a complex and vexing question, as is the question of Alfred's authorship of the Bologna Sermon, page 3 of your handout. In 1957, a seminal article by Enid Raines noted the close correspondence between the contents of Bologna 63 and Alfred's works. In it, Raines proposed that the Bologna Sermon was the main source of the Lives of Saints homily, further positing that the personal introduction with which both the Bologna and the Lives of Saints sermon begin, Quonnam diximus vobis et quillon erzi vi sedo thou, formerly we've said to you, in other words, perhaps suggests that Alfred wrote or compiled the source, i.e. the Bologna sermon, himself, but this cannot be certain. The same year, Neil Carr, inventorying Bologna 63 for his massive and hugely influential catalog of manuscripts containing Anglo-Saxon, offered the view that the Bologna sermon is perhaps Alfred's own. Milton Gatch, in 1966, reiterated Raines' view that Bologna was the source for the Lives of Saints homily, and that a decision on Alfred's authorship, while likely to be affirmed, quote, must await an exhaustive study of the texts, unquote. The following year, John Pope indicated that while he was inclined to agree with Raines and Carr's assessment, and although he included the piece tentatively in his overview of Alfred's canon, a warning of caution from Peter Clemmes had led him to suspend judgment on the matter. He said, quote, whether the Bologna Sermon is actually a piece of Alfred's composition, as indeed it appears to be, can hardly be satisfactorily determined without a thorough study of its relation not only to the Christmas homily just mentioned, but also to the partially rewritten version of that homily in Belfour 9, noting that he owed this cautionary advice to Clemmes as well. In 1969, Clemmes identified the source of the latter half of the Bologna Sermon as Alcuin's 8th century De Animae Ratione Liberet Alualium, and in 1985, Malcolm Godden identified one source for the first half of the Bologna Sermon as Alfred the Great's vernacular version of Boethius' De Consolatione Philosophiae. Comparing Alcuin and Alfred to the three Christmas sermons, however, Bologna, Lives of Saints, and Belfour 9, he came to a curious conclusion. Brace yourself for a minute here. The Bologna sermon seemed to be both the source for and the later product of the sermon in the Lives of Saints. On the one hand, Godden said, the close English version could have intervened between them. On the other hand, he noted the Lives of Saints sermon adds details to Alfred's version, which Alfred then expands in the first half of his Bologna text. His explanation runs as follows. First, in an early stage, Alfred made a Latin abridgment of Alcuin's treatise, Proto-Bologna, if you will. Second, he used this preliminary sketch as the basis for a sermon in the Lives of Saints, together with material original to himself and passages drawn from Alfred. Third, called upon to produce a Latin version of the Lives of Saints sermon, perhaps for another audience, even as he did for his pastoral letters for Wolfstan, to whom we'll come, he took his original Latin abridgment, Proto-Bologna, and added a translation of the other material in the Lives of Saints, resulting in the Bologna sermon in its final form. Finally, prompted to issue a new form of the vernacular sermon, he composed Belfour 9, drawing on the updated Bologna sermon for the first half and the updated second half of the Lives of Saints for the rest. You have about 2 more minutes of intense mental pain, and then this will be done, this section. Another view, however, had been proposed by Theodore Linebaugh in his 1980 Harvard thesis. Carefully analyzing the Bologna sermon use of Alcuin, Linebaugh concluded that the occasional awkwardness of the abridgment, with the occasionally abrupt transitions and constrained reliance on Alcuin's text, suggested that Alfred may not have been the author of the text, though he drew on it for the Lives of Saints in Belfour 9. In 1994, having considered Godden's view with what Christopher Jones calls laudable thoroughness and caution, Linebaugh again defended his position, where Godden argues that the opening of the Lives of Saints was composed in the vernacular and subsequently translated into Latin, Linebaugh hypothesizes that the opening too may derive from unidentified Latin sources. Where Godden views Bologna's expanding Lives of Saints, Linebaugh notes that Lives of Saints may just as easily condense the Bologna sermon. Furthermore, Linebaugh points to defects in the Bologna sermon which Alfred smooths over in the Lives. While not discounting the possibility of Godden's interpretation, therefore, Linebaugh affirms that the Bologna sermon may have been composed in full prior to the Lives of Saints, and that it need not have been composed by Alfred. Finally, and we'll come to the import of all of this, in 1998, Jones revisited the question in a larger treatment of Alfred's Latin compositional methods. In particular, he addressed Linebaugh's concern as to the apparent defects in the Bologna sermon's abridgment of Alcuin. Some of the doubts raised about Alfred's author of the Bologna Sermon, Jones' notes, reflect an unwillingness to believe that Alfred could have made a mess of cutting and pasting from his own Latin sources, or that his abridgments might have been anything less than worthy of one dubbed the Grammarian. It's not so implausible, however, he says, that Alfred could have compiled the Bologna Sermon sua mora in his own fashion by cutting, shifting, and reinserting words to yield a grammatically tolerable approximation whose textual interpretive shortcomings may only have emerged later in the more deeply analytical process of translation. This was possible because his methods of Latin to Latin and Latin to Old English composition differed in kind. Not only, in short, does the Bologna Sermon appear to underlie the Christmas Sermon in the Lives of Saints in 449, but Alfred may well have been its author. We have no time at present, thank goodness, to evaluate the subtle textual differences offered as evidence for the above perspective, or to focus on additional passages which further complicate the question of textual transmission and revision. My research thus far suggests that there is more data to be considered, and as yet I have not cast my final vote on the matter, though the last line of page 3 indicates my current leaning. On the other hand, another body of evidence previously not taken into account leads me to argue for Alfred's authorship of the Bologna Sermon because of the quotations from the Bible therein. We may begin with the quotations taken verbatim from the Vulgate, the Latin medieval Bible. Pages 4 and 5 on your handout lists the 13 such passages found in the Bologna Sermon, through which we may proceed with speed. Again, I should assuage those whose grace cells protest at such detail at the end of a long day that all one needs to note of these pages is the recurring, large, boldface ash, which is the AE ligature, which indicates Alfred's association elsewhere with the verses at hand. First, there's Christ's response to the Jews already noted from John 8. The Fontes Anglo-Saxonicae database out of Oxford listing sources for some 1,150 Anglo-Saxon texts lists six works besides the Old English Gospels incorporating the verse. Four of the works are by Alfred, and these are the only works to include the Jewish query, "Who are you?" that prompts Jesus' reply. Second, there is the warning from Ecclesiasticus or Sirach against inquiring about two matters too high for you. Aside from Bede, Alfred is the only one to show an interest in the verse, and nearly the only one to reference an adjacent passage. Third, there is the verse from Exodus mentioned above. Alfred refers to Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, in general in another supplementary homily, and the passage appears as well in the Old English Heptateuch. While Alfred did not compose this particular section of the Heptateuch, the verse nonetheless appears as a project with which Alfred was intimately involved. The same is true of quotation 5 on the handout, where in Genesis, Jacob vows to serve God if God gives him bread to eat, sustains him on his journey, and returns him safely to his father's house. The verse appears only in the Bologna 63 and the Heptateuch, and is, what is more, rare even among Latin patristic texts, appearing but 11 times in the whole of the Latin corpus. With the exception of these two verses from the Heptateuch, pages 4 and 5 of the handout show that these quotations were not only of importance to Alfred, but that in some cases he is the only Anglo-Saxon author associated with these verses. A similar pattern may be seen in the eight verses paraphrased in the Bologna Sermon, pages 6 and 7 on your handout. While analogs are more difficult to determine in this case, the nebulous nature of paraphrase makes identification through electronic searching a challenge. In 7 of the 8 cases, Alfred quotes the verse elsewhere. In 4 instances, Alfred quotes the verse in multiple works. On 5 occasions, Alfred is the only author to cite the verse. The one exception is number 4 on page 6 of your handout, where the Bologna Sermon quotes from Zechariah 8:9. Fontes lists no Anglo-Saxon text that cites either this verse or any part of Zechariah 8. Indeed, it only records 14 texts that draw on Zechariah at all. 5 of these, however, are by Alfred, including one drawing on Belfour 63, Bologna 63, Belfour 9. A different chapter altogether is posed by the remaining 4 quotations of the Bologna Sermon, as they all appear to follow the Septuagint or Greek translation of the Old Testament. This is, again, page 8 on your handout. Knowledge of and quotation is extremely rare in Anglo-Saxon England, which makes these 4 quotations all the more idiosyncratic. Frankly, I'm not sure what to make of these verses. On the one hand, the combination of the 4 texts is most unusual. The 3 Psalms, examples 2, 3, and 4 in table 6, are not so much the issue. All 3 are found, as one would expect, in books by Jerome, Cassiodorus, and Remigius of Auxerre, which are all major medieval expositions of the Psalms. Patrologia Latina, the Latin corpus, licks only one work, moreover, that also includes the passage from Isaiah. Our known text, 8th century author, was used by Alfred in composing the sermon in Bologna 63, If so, why would Alfrich, usually so insistent on the orthodox authority of his sources, have drawn on a 5th century African monk who attacked Augustine's doctrine of grace? If not, what was Alfrich's source? One would assume that he must be drawing on someone, as, to my knowledge, Anglo-Saxon usage of the Septuagint was considerably limited. Fontes, for example, lists only one text with the Septuagint reading, sourced by Cambridge's Laws on Love. Alfrich's usual immediate source for the Psalms was the Gallican Psalter, the form the Psalms prevalent in England and continental Gaul, even as apparent on example 4 on the table, where one of the supplementary homilies cites Psalm 77:25. What, then, is the Bologna Sermon doing with Septuagint-derived readings? The answer, whatever the source of the readings, is likely that they provide the author with vocabulary or images more suited to his rhetorical purpose than would the analogous readings from the Vulgate. As you can see in Table 7 on page 8, the four passages are closely integrated with other quotations taken verbatim and paraphrased from the Vulgate. In two cases, the Septuagint readings parallel the adjacent verse. The bread of angels, which descends from heaven, reminds one of the living bread that thence descends. The psalmist's procession into the altar of God follows smoothly from Moses' injunction not to ascend the Lord's altar on stairs. In the other two cases, the effect is contrastive. The bent backs of the faithless juxtapose nicely with Paul's call to stand firm in the faith, while Isaiah's exhortation to believe sits well against the subsequent injunction against inquiring unduly into mysteries. One may argue, of course, that the Fontes database is not exhaustive and that the sourcing of all vernacular and insular texts may well show that others made use of the verses in the Bologna Sermon. Be that as it may, Alfrich's documented use of nearly all the verses quoted in the sermon must be regarded as a significant connection. Though certainly possible, it would be remarkable to find another Anglo-Saxon author who made use of this particular set of verbatim quotations, paraphrases, and derivations from the Septuagint. The case for Alfrich's authorship of the sermon is strengthened, moreover, by one other factor, a consideration of the nature of the Bologna Sermon itself. Boulogne-sur-Mer, Bibliothèque Municipale 63, is a manuscript of two parts. The first section, folios 1 to 34, Gnoyce describes as an English work from the first half of the 11th century. The second, folios 35 to 86, he says originates in 10th century France. The latter contains four pieces by or formerly attributed to St. Augustine. The former, however, is our present concern. Table 8 on page 9 of your handout summarily outlines the contents of the first part of Bologna 63. A third of the items are pieces probably or certainly by Alfrich. Excerpts from Julian of Toledo's enormously popular 7th century anthology of patristic teaching on last things, the Prognosticon Futuri Saeculi, the unique copy of Alfrich's Latin letter to Wulfstan, item 2, the Bologna Sermon, item 3, De Septem Gradibus Ecclesiasticis on the 7 Priestly Orders, item 7, the Decalogus Moisi on the 10 Commandments, item 11. Seven were in turn used by Alfrich in other works, the excerpts from Julian of Toledo, number 1, possibly the extracts from Isidore's De Ecclesiasticis Officiis, number 5, De Septem Gradibus, number 6, the miscellaneous sentences on folio 25, that's number 8, the Sermon of Caesarius of Arles, and long attributed to Augustine, number 10, the Decalogus Moisi, number 11, and possibly De Servitio Carnis, number 14, on the Mosaic laws regarding slavery in about the 7 ages of the world. Four may not have been used by Alfrich directly, but echo themes present elsewhere in his work. The extract from Gregory's Regula Pastoralis, item 4, the excerpts from Commentaries and Letters of Jerome, item 7, the Pseudo-Galasium de Cradle, item 9, the warning against drunkenness, item 13. The only entry that does not have an obvious connection to Alfrich is the Easter homily of Eusebius Gallicanus, number 12, a text on which, to my knowledge, little work has been done. The prominence of Alfrician material in Bologna 63 led Raines, in fact, to suggest that it might be a copy of a manuscript which Alfrich kept for his personal use and in which he entered Latin sermons for translation and other items of interest. In 1966, Gatsch took up the idea that the exemplar for Bologna 63 was a commonplace collection, part of which he notes, like the Latin could not have been compiled until after Wulfstan's ascendancy as Archbishop II. Likewise, Jones, in his 1998 study, states that folios 1 to 34, quote, preserve what appears to be a copy of Florilegium, a bouquet of texts assembled by Alfrich, referring to the whole as the Bologna-sur-Mer commonplace collection. It is possible, in short, that Bologna 63 may be an early witness, perhaps with non-Alfrician accretions, of part at least of Alfrich's own handbook, a now lost collection of material that served as the basis for much of his influential work. the reconstruction or discovery of which would be a monumental step for Anglo-Saxon studies. Rather than subject you to the 10 additional pages of inscrutably torturous textual and paleographical analysis I had planned, a concluding summary of where our study has taken will be in order. Towards the end of the 10th century and the beginning of the 11th, at the end of the golden age of Old English literature, the great luminary of that age, over the course of his career, crafted 6 sermons for Christmas. Are you putting your things away? I have a conclusion. You can't put those away yet. In terms of content, the homilies are significant in and of themselves, expounding on the spiritual significance of the Christmas story, tracing the Old Testament prophecies that anticipated the event, considering with theological wonder the human beginnings of the eternal Lord. Through their problematic interrelationship, moreover, the homilies highlight 2 key challenges posed by medieval texts to students of manuscripts: dating and authorship. It seems clear enough that the first and second series sermons date from the beginning of Alfred's career, and that the supplementary homily was one of his last known compositions. In what order were the other 3 texts, 2 in Old English and 1 in Latin, written? More importantly, perhaps, for the study of medieval literature, how does one determine which work comes first? We discussed various theories about how one version may have led to another, a Latin original perhaps being translated into Old English and being refined subsequently for a different audience, for example, and also showed how the question of authorship may play a key role. Was the Bologna sermon, supposed by most to be the Latin source for the other 2 Old English homilies, written by Alfred or someone else? While authorship is often determined by scholars on stylistic grounds, in this case I proposed considering a different body of evidence, the biblical quotations that appear prominently in the Christmas sermons, and the various Old English authors who quote such passages in their work. Examining quotations taken word for word from the Latin Bible, the Vulgate, quotations paraphrased from the Vulgate, and quotations drawn most unusually from the Septuagint, that Greek translation of the Old Testament from the 1st to 3rd century B.C., we found that the one person known to have employed and repeatedly employed nearly all the verses quoted in the Bologna sermon, and in some cases the only person known to have quoted certain passages, was Alfred of Incham. Examining the context of the manuscript in which the Bologna sermon is found, moreover, showed that all but one of the works were by Alfred or potentially used by him. Indeed, the close association of the material in Bologna 63 with Alfred may constitute evidence that might help scholars reconstruct the handbook or original scrapbook of sources used by Alfred in the creation of his monumentally influential corpus of writings. For Christian scholars, in any case, what is certain is the lasting effect that these sermons have 1,000 years after their composition, as the circling earth brings to England, as to Bethlehem, the bleak midwinter. In lands more distant from his monastery than Alfred could e'er have dreamed, his words point, for those who have ears to hear, to the great word whose advent remains a cause for rejoicing indeed. Thank you.